As with tomorrow, what I'm going to try to do is to interpret those familiar passages in two very different ways. How a Jew would pray that psalm, and how a Christian might pray it with the faith convictions that we bring to our reading of the text. Well, so also with the passages tonight. What we've seen this week is that the binding of Isaac, one of the most central stories of the narrative of the ancestors. Why? Because Isaac is the child of promise, laughing boy, as we found out in Hebrew. Yitzhak, ha ha ha, because Sarah doubted the possibility that long past menopause, indeed 80 in the shade, that she would have a child. She thought that was laughable. And so the angel of God said, all right, just for your twitch of lack of faith there, you're going to have to call your kid laughing boy. Well, laughing boy is the child of promise. That's the reason why Abraham left Babylon, or what we now call Iraq, to go on this long and hazardous journey. And yet, God in chapter 22 issues this strange commandment, which seems to be in starkest conflict with his promise, namely to kill laughing boy. Take Isaac, thy dear darling, and go slaughter him. What an improbable commandment. Completely inconsistent with everything that we know about Old Testament faith, which thought that the practice of the surrounding neighbors of Israel, the Moabites and the Ammonites, were an abomination in the sight of Yahweh. They used to take their firstborn child and heave the poor little kid, just barely born, less than a year old, into a flaming cauldron to worship the god Moloch. And that practice was a temptation throughout the history of Israel. We find the prophets denouncing it right down to the time that we're studying here, namely the exile. Each succeeding generation is tempted to be like the other cultures and to have as many gods as possible and appease them all, you know. But in Israel, we learned in yesterday's session, the first commandment is no gods but Yahweh. The covenant requires this kind of close fidelity and a stipulation that we follow the laws that don't allow worship of these strange foreign gods. Then one other part that I didn't tell you about yet in the review of where we've been this week is the Passover narrative itself, where the themes of blood, water, and bread are used to epitomize this peasant rebellion, this insurrection, this act of revolution against the tyrannical dictator in Egypt. And each one of these poetic images or symbols has a double meaning of both life and death. It can be the destructive power of water, that you can drown in water after all, and any of you that have been up here in this wilderness area for long enough to take a hike out of camp know the utter essential character of water for our very survival in the wilderness, and so hence it means life. And so also with the imagery of blood and indeed of bread. And of course Christians reading these symbols, as we do above all in the Paschal event of the Easter setting, think of the bread and the blood in the Eucharistic setting of Jesus giving himself totally for us on the cross. His self-donation, no better gift than this, than what he does for us on the night before he dies, giving us precisely a reinterpretation of the Passover meal, much in the way that ancient Israel had reinterpreted the existing Canaanite meal and given it a radically new historical reference, namely to its own experience of liberation in Egypt. So that, I think, should set us up with a sufficient summary of where we've been this week, for those of you that haven't been here. And let me just say that my essential purpose in putting these juxtaposition of Jewish and Christian interpretations has been to relate to the theme of Holden this summer, of the creation of a whole new world, that our task as Christians in leaving Holden is to come out of this place with a very different attitude about Jews, because Christians have unfortunately put into their faith convictions a lot of hostility against the Jews that is not only unnecessary to our reading of our basic texts, but also, in fact, defeating of the central message of the gospel. Each night or each day, I have been reading a passage of a Christian leader that is derogatory towards the Jews. And my hope in doing this over and over again is that you'll get sick of it. Because that's the whole idea. Those who do the works of the law are rightly called, as the common saying puts it, the devil's martyrs. They take more pains and punish themselves more in purchasing hell than the martyrs of Christ do in obtaining heaven. They are tortured in a twofold way. While they live here, they torture themselves in vain by doing many and great works. When they die, they acquire the prize of eternal damnation and punishment. Thus, they are the most miserable martyrs, both in this life and in the life that is to come, and their bondage is eternal. That is from a commentary on Galatians by Martin Luther. And now let me read another little selection. The law was given in order that by its light the Jews might better come to know their cursed state and the more fervently and heartily desire the promised seed. In this they had an advantage over all the heathen world, but they turned this advantage into a disadvantage. They undertook to keep the law by their own strength and failed to learn from it their needy and cursed state. Thus, they shut the door upon themselves so that the seed was compelled to pass them by. Next Monday, I'm going to bring to a climax many of the anti-Jewish statements of Christian leaders over the Christian centuries and show that the Third Reich, in a very clever move of propaganda, appropriated much of the Christian literature of hatred towards the Jews. I'm going to call that session The Deepest Love and the Longest Hatred, to describe God's love for Israel and the Christian antagonism towards Israel. Because I think that we are living in a precious moment of history when we can recapture our Christian convictions with fresh and deeper faith and jettison these unnecessary and harmful anti-Jewish attitudes. And now on to tonight's theme, which is, who is the servant of whom the prophet that we find in the Isaiah scroll, but perhaps better known as 2nd Isaiah, because he writes not in the 8th century, the time of the Assyrian crisis, when the great prophet Isaiah wrote his scrolls, his messages, his oracles of warning to the northern tribes of Israel that they would get into deep trouble if they tried to form a covenant, a political treaty, with the Assyrians, which of course is what they tried to do, and the northern tribes were eliminated in the year 722. There was a great siege laid upon the capital of Judah, the southern kingdom, but the Jews, the southern people were known as the Judahites, or the descendants of David, and the Jews escaped in that moment, but not a century and a half later, when the Babylonians overthrew the Assyrian Empire and came to lay waste to Jerusalem because the king would not pay the tribute that was desired. So that's the situation of the time period in which we find our prophet writing, our unnamed prophet, but the Bible has tagged on chapters 40 to 55 to the earlier part of the scrolls and has sort of literally stitched them on there, and that's where we find them in the Bible today. So there's a first Isaiah and a second Isaiah, writing nearly two centuries apart. But this unknown second author, whose work is gathered up by the priestly editors of the second temple period in the Persian period, roughly 535 down to the time of Alexander the Great. That's the Persian period when the Greeks come to do trouble to the Jews. And then, of course, the Roman period is when the Romans take over from the Greeks, and that's the period that we're familiar with from the narratives about Jesus. One of the things that you should know, by the way, in Jewish-Christian studies is that Jews themselves are prepared to acknowledge the greatness of Jesus as a rabbi, as a prophet, as a message bearer from God our Father. And I use the "our" there quite intentionally to refer to both Jews and Christians. It is a remarkable new discovery that is going on among Jewish scholars. It is something that is very humbling and very wonderful, because it's enabling us Christians to recover the Jewishness of Jesus and to see the full meaning of what he preached about in the setting of the Palestine in his day. One other thing that you should know about this period is that the Messiah, or the Christ, the Anointed One — I remember growing up as a Christian, I didn't realize that Christ was a title, sort of like President Bush or Governor this or that. I thought of, you know, the family name. You know, there was Joseph Christ, Mary Christ, a little kid named Jesus Christ, and stuff like that. But it was only later, when I had further instruction in the matter, that I came to realize that it means the king. It means the Anointed One. It means the political ruler. And hence, we find an ambiguity at the time of the preaching of Jesus on his part about whether or not he will accept that title, because he does not wish to be known as the leader of a new political insurrection or rebellion against the Romans. He deliberately rejects that understanding of himself, in part because of the material that we're going to be looking at tonight. Indeed, these four parts of the Isaiah scroll were the parts of the Hebrew Bible that the Christian Church reflected on and incorporated into its own literature more than any other part of the Bible. Second, and a very close second, is the book of Deuteronomy from the Torah. They used the Psalms, Torah, and the prophets to give their interpretation of the question of who is this Jesus. Not just the gossip stories, what do you hear around the village about who Jesus is, but also the very personal question that Jesus addresses to each disciple: who do you say I am? And eventually, after his death and rising, the question gets answered that he's a king, he's an anointed one, he's the Christ. But we'll see in our look at John's Gospel tonight that there's an ambiguity and an irony there, because the only crown that he has is the crown of thorns, and the only enthronement ceremony that he goes through is the proclamation of the Roman governor that he is the king of the Jews. And it's a universal inscription, goes out to the whole world, and it's there for everybody to see in every language of the day, in Aramaic and in Greek and in Latin. And then Pilate gets really stubborn about it. He says, "Look, I said this guy is Caesar, and he's Caesar. He's the emperor. He's the new king." And that's the way it's going to be. So there's an irony in what John is saying, that in the suffering and the cross of Christ is the glory, is the exaltation, is the new Messiah to be found. Hardly, a successful guerrilla uprising, shameful, ignominious, painful, terrifying death is seen in John's Gospel as the way in which this servant, in fact, is exalted and triumphs. Now, the Messiah at the time of Deuteronomy is not Jesus. Jesus hadn't been born yet. But you find the term the Anointed One, the Christ, all over this part of the Bible. And this part stretches from chapter 40 to chapter 55. And then the remaining chapters, 55 to the end of the scroll, are known as Third Isaiah. Why? Because they're generally thought to be associated with the community back in Jerusalem after they've returned from the exile. Now, the reason why we know something fairly precise about the time of when this part of the document is going to be dated, and I'll pass around now a map of the ancient Near East, and it's not big enough that you can all see it, so I'll just pass it around, and you can see what the lay of the land was then in the 6th century. The last of the great Semite empires, they stretched from the time of Abraham, the Akkadians, and then the Babylonians, and now then the Assyrians, then followed by the Babylonians, are put to an end in precisely this time period when the book is being written. This is when Jerusalem is destroyed by the Babylonians, 586, and this is the year when they come back from captivity, from the exile, and are returned to Jerusalem by Cyrus the Great, Cyrus the Second, a Persian emperor. And so we know for sure at the outside it's got to be between these dates. But more particularly, because of several songs in this part of the Bible, we get references to Cyrus the Second. And we know from now extra-biblical literature, that is to say, stuff outside of the Bible, when he went about his military campaigns. Indeed, we can date them with great precision. In 559, he's an Indo-European, by the way, so who knows, maybe you're related to Cyrus. You look like Europeans to me in ancestry. You don't look very much like Iraqis or Africans or something. You don't look like Egyptians. So we all have something in common probably with Cyrus, at least in the language sense, that he's an Indo-European and puts an end to the great Semite empires that used to dominate ancient civilization. In 559, he becomes the king of a vassal city-state of the northern part of what is Iraq and Turkey, that border along which the Kurds are struggling for their existence today. You may have seen footage on television that shows these very high mountain passes and these people out in a kind of a wilderness area that survived by moving from one part of the country to the next, and that Saddam Hussein has victimized and brutalized for a very long, long time. Of course, we said nothing about it while he was our man in Havana or Baghdad. But then when it became convenient for us to make him the Hitler of the modern world, then of course we thought of him as a very evil man. But did nothing really to protect these Kurds that are the people from which Cyrus the Great emerged. So that will just tell you who the contemporary descendants of this guy are. Ecbatana fell in just a couple of years later, after he first picked up this tiny little outpost of the Babylonian Empire. He then went after the capital of the Medes, and it fell to his military prowess. And in one of the boldest moves of ancient history, equivalent to that of, say, Hannibal going over the Alps with elephants, I thought that was such an improbable way of conducting military matters, but then I'm not skilled in such history, so who am I to criticize Hannibal for using elephants to cross the Alps? Just look around you and wonder about that question. Isn't it easier to come by boat and, say, take a school bus? In any event, between the period 546 is when he first moves into Babylon. He takes over the city of Choresius in the north, as you see there in the map, and then in the year 539, it takes over the capital city, Babylon itself, one of the sites of the great wonders of the ancient world, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Think about that when you think about the smart bombs and the precision bombing that we did on that city. It's sort of like to get inside of that experience for a Muslim, it might help you to think of the Air Force promising precision pinpoint bombing of Florence. Florence, Italy. Or pick some place in the world that for you is filled with great treasures, filled with wonderful art, with the stuff of your civilization for centuries, and then rely on the hope that we'll get it just right with pinpoint bombing. That's probably why so many of the people of that part of the world will resent us, because we haven't done the act of Cyrus liberating them from a schmuck like Saddam Hussein. I'm not here to write a long speech about the glories of Saddam Hussein, don't get me wrong. I'm just trying to say that all these military ventures are always fraught with ambiguity and always difficult. And that's the kind of stuff, the stuff out of CNN is exactly the context in world history that our anonymous prophet, Isaiah, is dealing with. He's dealing with the stuff of warfare, of turmoil all over the place, of the disruption of an empire, the shattering of Babylon, and yet he turns out to be one of the most magnificent prophets of hope of all history, of all time. Who of us, hasn't, if once we've heard Handel's version of the Messiah, can't recall these strains that come out of this part of the Bible? Comfort ye, comfort ye. You've paid double price for your sins, and you're going back now. They all have these kind of almost musical associations for us when we read this part of the Bible, perhaps because of Handel's setting of them. But if they don't, if you've never heard the Messiah, that's okay. I'll just tell you only one Messiah joke, and then we'll get on with the rest of our business. But one of the things that we've been told on the teaching staff is that we should introduce a bit of hilarity into the life of Holden. So this is my contribution to that effort, and it's a true story. We always have to say that about Gaffney family stories. My daughter Elizabeth, who's now 16 and here at Holden with me, upon hearing the aria in Handel's Messiah that goes, "And we like sheep have gone astray," and you may recall, those who know the musical score, that it repeats, "And we like sheep, and we like sheep," like that. She snuggled up to me and said, "Yes, Daddy, but we don't like pigs very much." So enough for the levity, and now let's on with the text. I wonder if there's a Bible or two that we could throw upstairs to our friends there. We're going to be spending a few minutes in quiet time now. Here you go. It's an odd thing to do to Torah, but do you wonder it? Okay. Are there more Bibles there?
Yeah, there are.
Okay. What I'd like you to do is just read these four verses from chapter 42, verses 1 to 4. Read chapter 49, 1 to 6. Read chapter 50, verses 4 to 11. And then read the one that probably is the most familiar to you, or most familiar to most in the room, from chapter 52. The fourth song starts at verse 13, and it goes down to the end of chapter 53. So if there's anybody that can't read those numbers, I'll repeat them. First one is chapter 42, verses 1 to 14 of the prophet Isaiah. It's 1 to 4. It's a very short song. You'll see it marked in your Bible. The next one is chapter 49, verses 1 to 6. And chapter 50, verses 4 to 11. And then chapter 52, verse 13, down to the end of chapter 53. And we'll just spend some quiet time. We'll take as long as it takes for all of us to have read those. Do you want a Bible yourself? And be asking yourself, as you read these passages, who is this guy? Who is this servant? See if you can associate it with anything else that you've heard about in your upbringing. Let me interrupt for 1 second. I realize that I promised silence, but I'm going to break my vow of silence here. Ask yourself as you're reading these texts, not just who is he, but what's he all about? What's his purpose? What's his mission? What's his task? What is he being sent to do? What's his function? What's his job description? Something like that. And if you got the point of the second part of the assignment, it's not just what's his name, but give him a job description. What's he up to? The second one, I'll write them in bigger.
44.
No, it's 49. Okay. Well, I'll do this all from all of them, so it's really easier to see. I realize that you're at a distance. This one is easy to remember because it's just the opposite.
Can I read 44?
Huh?
Can I read
44? Sure, you can read anything between 40 and 55 and it'll help us. Oops! Anything in that part of the Bible will help us a lot. And it's all relevant. Okay, fine. Let's start just by looking at the first of the songs in chapter 42. Unless, of course, anybody can sing the opening of chapter 40 from the Messiah. It requires a female voice. Actually, no, it's a tenor, isn't it?
It's a tenor.
Come 40, come 40, my people, etc. Speak ye tenderly to Jerusalem. So that's an interesting. Why are they speaking tenderly to Jerusalem if they're over there in the exile? And cry to her that she has served her term, that her penalty is paid. She has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Well, he's obviously talking to the community that wants to be in Zion. You remember the psalm that where the Babylonians are taunting the Israelites in exile, oh, sing for us a Zion song. They say, how could we possibly do that? We hang our harp up on a tree. We don't want to sing here. It's this very sad place to be. We've been torn away from the temple. This is a very sad, discouraged, beaten, defeated people that Isaiah has a ministry to. And what a message that in the face of the most improbable odds, the mightiest empire of the world, Babylon, is now going to yield or fall to an invading army that will be the source of liberation for the people, unlike the peasant uprising in Egypt. Indeed, last time we saw, or the time we studied the Passover, that some of the people in Jerusalem beat it out of there in a hasty retreat, notably the prophet Jeremiah, the greatest of the pre-exilic prophets in that time period. And where did he go? To Egypt. So that the great historical credo of Deuteronomy 26, of Abraham coming down into Egypt through his children, spending some time there, and then out of Egypt, and finally into the promised land where Israel would be there, they thought, forever and ever. If you break the covenant, whether the covenant at Sinai that the people of Israel are fooling around down at the base of the mountain, then those tablets get broken and you have to get a new covenant going. Well, so also with Jeremiah, you've got to get a new covenant going if the people break off this covenant. Something new has to start up, just as it would happen at the beginning of every single king. A new monarch meant a new covenant, a new proclamation of the laws. Well, here we get the royal proclamation of who the new king is. It's very evocative in Hebrew. Hineh ha'ish. Look at this man. Where have you heard that before? Behold the man. Behold the man. Where have you heard that before? Pilate says it of Jesus in the coronation ceremony in John's Gospel. It's a technical term in Latin as well as in Hebrew. That's the way David would have been enthroned. Behold your king. Behold, here he is. Take a good look. Hine ha'ish. That's how this song begins. Behold, the servant. And whose servant is he? Who's the subject of this? Who's doing the imperative here? Is it a king announcing his successor? It is parliament saying, you know, God save the King George VI, and Queen Elizabeth has come now. Behold the new queen. Long live the queen. It's not parliament. It's
God.
It's God. It's God. It's my servant. And the subject of this sentence is God. And my Messiah, my anointed one, my servant, the one whom I uphold, my chosen in whom I have delight. Where have you heard these kind of words before in your Christian upbringing? Do you recall anything in the New Testament that identifies who this person is?
This is what you love, my son.
Right. Who says that?
God.
God. To whom? To Jesus at the time of his baptism. For Luke, it's a time of prayer, of internal quiet reflection upon the scrolls of Israel. It's the only Bible he has. And he comes to the realization that he is designated as the chosen one, and will then spend the rest of his ministry trying to elaborate how he can be the faithful son of his father and servant of his brothers and sisters. He, like Moses, will go on a long and hazardous journey. From our perspective, it's not too difficult of a hike from Galilee down to Jerusalem. But for him, it was the path to glory that was the path to death. And in Luke, and the other place where this passage occurs is not just at the baptism, but also on the Mount of Transfiguration, where, as we saw yesterday, he's compared to the new Moses and the new Elijah, the person who embodies both the law and the prophets. And then when he comes down from the Mountain of Transfiguration, they have a conversation about where he's going on his journey. Does anybody recall where he's going? I just told you, it's Jerusalem. But the term in Greek is very interesting. Usually it's translated his departure or his journey to Jerusalem. In fact, in Greek the term is exodus, his path out of, his, or we might say more literally, his exodus story. From this land to the land of his father, so as to gather a brand new kingdom that would not have political bosses like pharaohs or king of the Babylonians or Roman emperors or the like. His kingdom is very different to any other kind of rule, and hence it is a rule that is established, and we know this from this song, not by lording it over folks. Instead, we get kind of some strange negative prohibitions about what kind of an anointed one or what kind of a ruler he's going to be. What are they here in chapter 42? There are three images that are, or three negative prohibitions of what kind of Messiah he's not supposed to be. And what are they?
Not cry out or lift up his voice.
Okay, that's number one. And number two?
Bruised reed.
He's not going to break this reed that's kind of fragile as it is. He's not going to snap it. And thirdly, he's not going to snap out this barely lit thing. Indeed, we'll see in one of the next songs you may have already seen, he's going to be a bright light to all the Goyim, all the nations, all the Gentiles are going to be see something new in what this prophet has to say. And what is it that his mission is? We know negatively how he's not supposed to do it. And it's a pretty surprising negative prohibition to be put on the guy, considering what his mission is. What's his mission?
Justice
in the earth. So it's everywhere, all over the place, not just a tiny local municipal ordinance, like you can't park your car between 2 and 4 on this side of the street because we need to sweep the streets. But that's not an ordinance that would be found in every part of the world, because streets aren't always swept on Tuesdays in every part of the world. Whereas this law is meant for promulgation. Why do they call it a law? It says justice here. But the term in Hebrew is mishpat, and it really means a verdict. It's a technical legal term that means the conclusion of a trial, And all throughout Isaiah, he uses the language of a trial. He talks about plaintiffs, defendants, witnesses, verdicts, indeed, I forgot one of the favorite things of prosecutors, indictments. And in this case, the best way to get a handle on what the trial is all about is to name the parties. Yahweh is the plaintiff, and the defendants are the goyim, the Gentiles, the nations. More properly, more precisely, it is the gods of the Gentiles. And perhaps the quickest way to get a handle on that is to read another exilic piece of literature for Psalm 115. You perhaps know this already, but it's a taunt against the Babylonian deities. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths, but do not speak, eyes, but do not see. There's all these statues of all the gods of the Babylonians in the temple there. They have hands, but do not feel, feet, but do not walk, make no sounds in their throat. Those who make them are like them. And what kind of gods are those? Anthropomorphic, they look like us, but they don't really behave like us. Whereas our God is Yahweh, the one who comes to be with us in the midst of our suffering and who is to be disclosing his ways in a very short while. Well, then that's a very public act at the end of a trial. You're supposed to proclaim it. Let everybody know what the result is. Who won that trial? And the answer is Yahweh. And then you would normally shout it out, you know, if it's not, you know, something to be hidden or kept quiet about. And yet the very next verses says, he will not cry or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he shall not break. A dimly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth this mishpar. It's something that's going to take a long while for this message to get across. The usual way of taking out a full-page ad in the New York Times isn't going to be it, or any other slick hustle on how to sell the message. It isn't going to be any easy way to persuade the nations of what's up in history, of what's really happening. Even though the claim of the Babylonians is a legal nullity, it's void, of no effect, it's unenforceable, you're not going to do it by hiring lawyers and, worse yet, by hiring Madison Avenue. And I guess I can say that because I'm a lawyer. So that's what we learn about this fellow in the ancient world, and we learn already that we didn't settle the hash of whether or not it was an individual prophet. It seems so, but it could be the collectivity of Israel. Let's put that question as an open one. We also saw that the early church began to reflect on this scroll and interpret it as referring to Jesus in the baptism narrative and in the transfiguration narrative. Okay? Now the second servant song is in chapter 49. Again, who is this? What is this person? And what do we know about him? And what's he up to? So let's turn to the second song. Now who's the subject of the sentence? Listen to me, you coastlands, and hearken, or listen up, you folks way off. Now it's the servant himself. It's not God that's addressing the nations. It's the servant himself. So we might get a clue as to his identity. Right in the first part, you get some idea, well, what's going on here? So we're going to get a different idea. And we hear all about his call, his election, what kind of equipment he's to have. Indeed, then again, you see this installation part, Hine Haish, you are my servant, which is the same background as in the baptism and transfiguration narratives. The parts that have to do with the call are dramatically similar in many respects to the prophet Jeremiah, called from his mother's womb, as we see here, Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 15, called to be sent to the Gentiles in Jeremiah 1, chapter 1, verse 10, and over in chapter 25, the same thing. The message of Jeremiah is one of doom. You may recall that funny picture of Jeremiah acting out the parable of what it's going to be like for the people in Jerusalem by walking around the city with half a yoke. He was quite a yokester. Around his neck, and you know, imagine this guy with an oxen cart type thing, and he's in one of them, and there's room for another oxen there, and he's walking all around Jerusalem like that, until people ask him, what are you doing that for? He says, well, guess what, buddy, there's room there for you. We're all going to be carted off out of here because of our infidelity. So he was always full of practical jokes, mean jokes from the perspective of the establishment. They didn't like him very much. He wasn't a comfortable prophet. He was a troublemaker, like Elijah before him. He didn't have sweet, soothing, pleasant words to say to the people. He told it like it is, and got into deep trouble for it. Suffered at the hands of the king, at the hands of the priests. He was right on the top of the FBI most wanted list. When he wasn't in trouble, it was only because he was out of town. So that's Jeremiah. And yet he's also, again, like this prophet, a prophet of great happiness and great joy of the coming possibility of a brand new covenant and all kinds of new things happening all over the place in the midst of this incredible suffering and pain that his people is going through. Why? Because for Jeremiah, as for this prophet, suffering is a means not simply of destruction, but of purification. Much as fire was for the Kenites in the Sinai experience, this purifying fire of the Sinai experience of God manifesting himself in this strange symbol, just as water was at the crossing of the Reed Sea, and just as the blood shed upon the lintels of the peasants in Egypt was a sign of hope for them and of destruction to their oppressors. Well, so also is suffering of the servant, of the prophet, both painful, terrifying, brutal, harsh, awful, and yet purifying, cleansing, and full, therefore, of, in a way that's baffling and mysterious, of hope and of promise, and of even one might say of new life. But a very realistic guy, Jeremiah, as is this Deuter Isaiah, easy to recognize that he gets discouraged, he gets down. Where do we find that here? In chapter 49.
Verse 4.
Yeah, what's he say? What does your Bible say? He says,
I've labored in vain. I've spent my strength for nothing in vanity.
Yeah, I mean, that. Can you get more down than that? You know, my whole life's work's a, you know, it's really a bummer. It's going nowhere. It's nowhere. And yet he concludes that verse, yet surely my cause is with the Lord and my reward with my God. So this prophet who has a mission to the ends of the earth and who is not going to declare the mishpat or the judgment the way that lawyers normally do, but who's going to do it patiently, gently, is now portrayed to us as a person who gets discouraged because he's a person who has to suffer like others. And yet the images, too, that were given of what his equipment is like, that of a sharp sword and a polished arrow. And what is the sword able to do? What's a sword good for?
Cut things.
Penetrating insight, we say. Oh, wow, you broke through my defenses. You cut through my bullshit. And you got right to the point. You laid bare, you exposed my vulnerability to the point where I just had to admit, yep, that's really the better way of seeing things. I admit it. the letter to the Hebrews calls God's word a two-edged sword. It cuts up and down and penetrates to the very marrow of the bone and finds the place where we just can't say no anymore, where we finally have to admit, yeah, that's the way things are. But we don't like to admit it right away. We put up our walls and our defenses. And the other thing is this arrow. Well, what's the point of the polished arrow? Shoots Bambi. No,
it's also sin. It's in his quiver.
Right, it's in his quiver, and you're onto something here. But I just want to push it one tiny step further, and that's a clue. Further. It reached much further than a sword. A sword is about hand's length, or I have to come over to get through to you. Whereas with my bow and arrow, I can shoot. Have very long range, and this, remember, is a prophet that's got a message to send to the Gentiles and long way off. So that's the point of that metaphor, is that he's on mission now, not just to Israel, but to everybody. It's to the whole nations, to the isles, to the coastline, way out there. Get the message way out there. It's going to be powerfully significant in the debate in the early Christian church about whether the church should remain a community for Jews who acknowledge that Jesus is this servant or the Messiah, or whether or not it ought to be a message for the Gentiles, to the church at large. And indeed, we find again that the early church, reflecting on this scroll of Isaiah, interprets it to refer itself to the entire Gentile mission. You find that in Acts chapter 13, verse 47. Those of you who want to take a note, check that out. Or chapter 26, verse 23. Those two places, the author of Luke-Acts, suggests that this portion of the Isaiah scroll is really describing the evangelization of everybody in the Roman Empire. Much as in Matthew chapter 12, the first scroll, chapter 42 of Isaiah, chapter 12, verses 18 to 21, is quoted verbatim in Matthew to refer to Jesus. Now let's take a look at the third scroll, chapter 50, verses 4 to 11. And again, who is this guy and what's he up to? Now we get him spoken about in the third person, right? It's God, or the Lord Yahweh, has given me the tongue who are taught so that I may know how to answer the weary with the word. What do we sort of hear about this? I guess the prophecy in Israel is like hearing and speaking like a disciple. It's one who is faithful, and it's sort of like one of those psalms that are called a lament, that a person is in grief and so forth, a psalm of lament. But it's really, I would better characterize it as a psalm of confidence in the face of difficulties, because it's not just, one of the cardinal rules of Holden. I'm sure if you haven't seen this one, you will. Got to encircle the wine and then forget it. This prophet isn't a whiner. He isn't calling attention to his suffering just to say, oh boy, that feels good. Oh, it's so wonderful to suffer. He is not a masochist, and above all, he's not one who wants to inflict suffering upon others. But as we'll see, tragically, that's exactly what Christians did with these passages. They turned them to a taunt against the Jews and then turned them into an instrument of killing Jews through the Christian centuries. So it's a psalm of confidence being spoken by the person in ancient Israel at the time of Deuteronomy. He's certain that he'll be answered. And he's got this knowledge in verse 5 that there are assaults, there are attacks upon him. He knows that life isn't easy. And again, that's just a page out of the book of Jeremiah. It's just almost verbatim the description here in this chapter and the description of the life of Jeremiah, the complaints about his enemies and so on. So this is a person who knows what loneliness is. This is a person who knows what suffering is, but who doesn't relish in it, who doesn't just think, oh boy, how wonderful it is, but who is confident that in the midst of all of this pain, he will find a way out, and in the midst of all this loneliness, he will find the deepest possible community, namely the bond of friendship and love from God himself. He protests his own innocence, and that's where it gets like one of these Psalms of Lament. You've undoubtedly read them, how come all this stuff is happening to me, oh God? What are you doing up there? I'm a good guy. Why are you beating up on me? Those kind of psalms. Whereas this is not exactly in that genre or in that type. He describes the hostility. I give my back to the smiters, my cheek to those who pulled my beard. When have you read those words before? Who is this guy?
In the passion
narrative, you find that this, and who is it that is pulling whose beard? And now you know why European artists portray this fellow with a beard, because we otherwise don't know whether he was clean shaven or had facial hair. It's to use this bit of the scroll that they put a beard on. We don't have any historical evidence that Jesus had a beard. Maybe he had a mustache, for all we know. And it could have been a handsome bucko like that. But we don't know what. Maybe he had an elegant gray beard, such as... I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name, Marie. What is it?
Ron.
Such as Ron's beard. But in any event, imagine poor Ron having his beard yanked by a Roman soldier. Pretty painful, not pretty awful. This kind of abuse is not something to rejoice about, but it's something, all this shame and spitting and so on like this. You recall surely the spit that's hurled against Jesus in the Passion narrative. So again, you can see that the early church is using these texts to identify Jesus as the servant. And we shall see as well that the church moves beyond just identifying Jesus, but in understanding itself as the servant that has to go through this kind of persecution and turmoil at the hand of the Romans. So that in its first martyr, it has Stephen dying in the way that Jesus dies, suffering the way he suffers, praying the way he prays to the very end. Those of you that have had some conversation with Fred Nieder in the Bible study this week may recall that in his study of the Passion according to Luke, he pointed out that there are two prayers on his lips. One that his mommy taught him, the "Now I lay me down to sleep" prayer, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit," that psalm, that every Jewish mother would teach her kid to pray as the bedtime prayer. And so that's the prayer he prays as he's confidently going to sleep in the Lord. The other one is, of course, the prayer of the Abba prayer that we've come to incorporate into the Lord's Prayer, namely, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." What a prayer to pray. It's the prayer of Dr. Martin Luther King on the night before he died, not knowing, of course, that an assassin's bullet would fell him the next day. But he prays that all of his detractors and all of his enemies, some of them very high placed in the government, I might add, having served in the Justice Department for a while, I can tell you that, that whoever they were, it's okay. Longevity has its place, he says, and I'd love to be with you in this movement for a long while, but bombs were going off all over the South, church, home, wherever, and so he knew that he wasn't, necessarily long for this life and ready to go. It's the prayer, for example, of Thomas More. Those of you who've seen the movie A Man for All Seasons, will have been cheated of the real words of Moore in his trial, which are written down by his son-in-law, Roper, who says, when the verdict comes in by this ludicrously unreflective jury, it doesn't understand the perjury of Richard Rich, that lied about Moore, because Moore was a shrewd lawyer and he knew that silence would give him a perfect defense under British law, that he wouldn't have to suffer the consequences of any act of Parliament if he just kept his big mouth shut about who Henry was, which is what he did. But the improbable thing that he would tell this sleazebag, Richard Rich, what he thought about the king, was the basis for his being executed. And he turns to his jurors in Roper's version of the trial when the king's judge pronounces the sentence of death upon him. And he says, trot him off to the tower to be executed. And he says, wait a minute, the accused under British law has the right of a few words before being executed. And then the judge says, oh yeah, that's right, yeah, okay, what would you like to say? He turns to the jurors and says, remember Stephen and remember Paul? Remember how Paul was one of the witnesses in Deuteronomy? He doesn't quote the Bible quite so literally, but he evokes this scene of the dying Stephen. He says, here's Paul gathering up the garments, serving as one of the witnesses at the execution of Stephen. But now Stephen and Paul are two of God's dearest friends in heaven. And that's the way I hope it'll be between me and you. You've sent me to my death now, but, you know, we're all in God's hands, and, he dies with an act of forgiveness on his hands. And that's exactly what Stephen says. He says, first of all, Lord Jesus, lay not this charge against them. And then, Father, I commend myself into your hands. He prays for forgiveness the same way. And then dies the way that Jesus does. And the point of that is, of course, that Stephen is us. Stephen is just another Christian who's supposed to be praying the Abba prayer just the way we're supposed to be praying. Luther said of the Lord's Prayer that one of the biggest troubles with it, and we'll see that next week when we study a whole unit on the Lord's Prayer. The trouble with the Lord's Prayer, Luther says, is that Christians pray it too often. Our Father, right in heaven, I'll be there, or whatever. You know, they go through it as though it were a magical incantation or something, or just one of those rituals. We say the words sometimes quickly, often thoughtlessly. It's just one of the things we do. And so he would have us say it very slowly. St. Teresa of Avila, a mystic in Spain, used to tell her nuns, never pray it so quickly that you haven't grasped each word. And then she writes in her journal after telling the nuns that, this is the third day in a row, I can't get past the first two words. She never could get past our. She just stopped, our. Father, my God. She didn't get to who art in heaven. That's as far as she could get. Great contemplative mystic, you would think she'd know those words. She would have pondered them. I mean, what the heck the nuns do in convent all day long? Ponder words and this and that and corporate in the light. You figured she'd get to the end of the Our Father. She could get to the second word. So here is a very different style to an approach to how to go about these matters. Even though you have an urgent matter on your hand, you have a lot of business to do. Is this